My name is Victor Kubik, President of the United Church of God. Welcome to Inside United. Today, our guest is Scott Ashley, Managing Editor of Beyond Today magazine. But he's also here to teach the Gospels at Ambassador Bible College at the home office. Scott is also pastor of the church, the United Church of God, in Denver, Colorado Springs, Frisco. And, of course, as I mentioned, he's the Managing Editor of Beyond Today magazine. I can't believe all the different things that he does. He's become a very close and good friend over the years, and I have appreciated all the many things that I have learned. Welcome to Inside United.
Thank you, Vic. Very, very good to be joining with you here today.
Scott's special interest here of late, at least he's been talking about it for the last couple of years, has been archaeology. And he's taken a very special interest in studying it, going to conferences and so forth. And it's archaeology as it relates to the period of the Gospels and perhaps either other biblical periods. But Scott, what are some of the interesting archaeological finds that are related to the period of the Gospels? Can you tell us about some?
Sure. Well, one of my favorite stories, and I shared this with the Gospels class at ABC, is about the Bethesda pool that's mentioned in the Gospel of John, where Jesus heals a man who's been lame there for many, many years. And the Gospel of John describes this pool as being north of the temple, near the sheep gate, which is where they brought the sheep in for the temple sacrifices. And John mentions this particular pool had five porches, or colonnades is what it's referring to. And people assume that meant it was five-sided, like the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And this was actually used as an argument against the authenticity of the Bible for years, because no five-sided pool has ever been found anywhere in the ancient world. It's just unheard of. However, in 1964, archaeologists were excavating in this same area north of where the temple was located, and they found this rectangular pool that dated to the first century when they got down to that level. And what was interesting, this pool has four sides, being a rectangle, but it also had a colonnaded porch that ran through the pool and divided it in half. So you had the four sides plus one down the middle makes five, exactly as John described in his gospel. And what's really interesting about this is Jerusalem was destroyed not too long after that in 70 AD, and this pool was buried under many feet of rubble and debris. So anybody who, as some critics say, the Gospels were invented later by other people who didn't know what they were talking about, and they're all inventing this. Well, this is all buried in 70 AD, and 2,000 years later, they dig down to this level and find this pool exactly as John described. So rather than it being proof against the Bible, as people used to think, it's actually a staggeringly important proof that the Bible record is accurate there. So that's just a neat story.
Does this make any of the archaeologists believers?
hard to say. It certainly, I'll put it this way, it certainly quieted down a few of them there who were critical of that. And similar story, just about 10 years ago, there's another pool that's mentioned that's involved in one of Jesus's healings, the Pool of Siloam. And for a long time, archaeologists thought they knew where this pool was, but then about 10 years ago, a sewer pipe in the city of Jerusalem sprang a leak. They went to repair it and dug down, and as they're digging out this pipe to repair it, they found some steps. And they started digging these steps, and they went further and further and uncovered this huge pool there that now we know was the Pool of Siloam, the actual pool that is mentioned there in the gospel. Very elaborate pool that was one of the major water supplies there in the first century there in Jerusalem. So I got to see that pool years ago, just a month or two after it had been excavated in Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. I know you've been there and you're going there again next year, it looks like.
Yes. Yeah, love to. And they're finding new things all the time there. That's what's really really interesting and exciting about archaeology. Every year they're finding new things. So like going back there and seeing what's new, what have they found in the last year. Another really interesting area that relates to the first century in the Gospels is rolling stone tombs, like the one that Jesus was buried in. Mm-hmm. They found four, five, six Rolling Stone tombs from that period, including several right around Jerusalem. And the bodies were laid out on a kind of a stone bench in the tomb, exactly as is described in the Gospels. And Peter and John in the Gospel accounts run to the tomb, and they have to stoop down to look in. And that's exactly what we see with the architecture of these tombs from the first century. So everywhere you look, they just find more and more things that confirm little details like that that we read about in the Gospels.
Well, I know that for those of us who are believers, it makes us even more believers.
Yes, absolutely.
As a result. I mean, it just shows how inerrant the Bible is, where on the surface it may seem, well, maybe not, but then all of a sudden they find these things. And it's amazing how much digging there is. I was in Jerusalem in 1969, 50 years ago, graduation, worked a little bit on the project, their excavation. And you would think they've already dug up the whole country, you know, with all the projects they've had.
Yeah, most sites in Israel, they've only excavated, well, of the sites they have excavated, generally, they've only excavated 2 to 3% of the sites. Most of it is still untouched. So
amazing. There's still a lot more discoveries of verification coming.
Definitely.
We have in the March-April edition of Beyond Today magazine, which you're managing editor of, there are two articles, or they cover one page, about some finds that have been discovered in that area.
Sure.
Tell us about them.
Sure. Well, yeah, these are both really interesting. The one was reported fairly widely in the media recently. It was a ring. And it was actually found about 50 years ago, but it was stored away for about 50 years because nobody thought it was important. And then within the last year, archaeologists decided to take a closer look at this ring because it was encrusted with mineral deposits for being buried in the ground for nearly 2,000 years. And they took it out and they cleaned off the mineral deposits and looked at it with various forms of magnification and found out it had on it a Greek form of the name Pilate. Mm-hmm. Pontius Pilate is the Roman governor who presided over the trial of Jesus Christ. And it has his name on it. And it was interesting because it was found at one of the palaces of the family of King Herod, who's mentioned in the Bible, but his son's descendants ruled and over that area and would have interacted with Pontius Pilate. And this ring was found at one of those palaces, which gives credence to the fact that this would have belonged to the Roman governor. It's found at one of Herod's son's palaces. So,
but it's in Greek.
In Greek, which Greek was the common language that was used in that day for government business. It's the common people spoke Aramaic or Hebrew, but the language that was used, the common language that everybody understood, kind of like English is today, was Greek.
The business language, so to speak.
Business language, big business, correspondence, government, government decrees, that sort of thing. And so that's neat. This is actually the second confirmation of the existence of Pontius Pilate in the 1960s at Caesarea Maritima on the coast, archaeologists found a stone inscription bearing the name of Pontius Pilate in a temple that was actually built there. He was involved in the construction of this temple. So we have two confirmations of the existence of a Roman governor by the name of Pontius Pilate in that area from that time frame. And then the second archaeological artifact, it didn't make a lot of news, but in northern Italy, not too far from Venice, they found a skeleton of a man from the first century, examined it, and found a hole in the heel bone of this skeleton, and finally realized, concluded the only way this hole could have been made was by having a nail driven through it in crucifixion, exactly as we see in the Gospels of Jesus Christ. He had nails driven through his hands and feet. And there was actually back in the 60s also, a skeleton of a first century Jewish victim found near Jerusalem who had been crucified. And in his case, they actually still found the heel bone, but with a nail still intact driven mm-hmm. through it. So it wasn't driven through the top of the feet as is commonly portrayed in art, but was instead driven through the heels of the feet into the side of the post. So we know that now from two separate examples of skeletons of people who were crucified from that time.
Terrible way to die. Terrible way to suffer.
Horrible. Yeah. Yeah, there are lots of other things being found. One really exciting area of biblical scholarship in recent decades is several decades ago, American Bible scholars started going to Israel to learn more about the background of the Bible and started interacting with Hebrew scholars and the Jewish scholars living in Israel. And the Jewish scholars knew everything about the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. The American scholars knew everything about the New Testament, and they got together comparing notes and found there are all kinds of references to Jewish customs in the Gospels, even in Paul's writings to a lesser extent. And comparing notes, now they are just opening up whole new areas of understanding in scholarship. We live 2,000 years later and have no clue what some of these references meant in the Bible. When the gospel writers wrote their books, I don't think they ever imagined we would be reading these 2,000 years later, because they thought Christ was coming in their day. We know that from Paul's writings. But, and even Bible translators, when the King James Bible was translated 400 years ago, 1611, they didn't know what a lot of these terms meant. So there's some awkward and incorrect translations in some cases. But now, by comparing what these Jewish scholars have known, because Jewish culture hasn't changed a lot in the last 2,000 years. So comparing notes, now there's we're getting to better understand the Gospels, different, rather obscure references in there. But now they're starting to make sense. For instance, Jesus uses teaching methods that are very common among first century rabbis. He uses parables, for instance, which we now know were common, a common teaching mm-hmm. method in that day. Another interesting technique, it's one of my favorites, it's called remez. It's an oblique way to referring back to events that happen in the Old Testament period and drawing lessons. Jesus used this. This method is used 300 to 400 times in the Gospels, and Jesus is pointing people back to the writings of the Old Testament to draw lessons from them. And it kind of makes the idea that Jesus came to do away with the Old Testament ridiculous, because he continually refers people back to that through this particular teaching method. So,
well, could you give us a couple of examples of remez?
Okay, a couple of really obvious ones. One of the first ones that shows up is the first few words of John's gospel. He says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." That phrase, "in the beginning," is a direct quote from Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so John is referring his readers back to Genesis. Genesis talks about in the beginning God created, and John is saying, okay, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Hey, let me tell you about that God. Here's the story of how he came to earth and lived among us. And verse 14 of John 1, he talks about he came in the flesh. He became flesh and lived among us, as John words it there. So that's one. Jesus calls himself the Son of Man 84 times in the Gospels. That's a reference back to a prophecy in Daniel, where Daniel sees this vision of a being he calls the Ancient of Days. And then he says, one like a Son of Man was brought before him. And we know now the Ancient of Days is representing, is God the Father. Jesus is the Son of Man. The Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days, is given a kingdom, an everlasting kingdom, will rule over the earth and all peoples and all of this. And Jesus applies this term Son of Man to himself because he is the Son of Man in Daniel's prophecy. So those are two that are very obvious, but again, there's just hundreds of them sprinkled throughout the Gospels.
I heard one of your studies online. We talked about Remes, and it was a very good one, very popular. It was shared among many people that I know.
Yeah, and the students just love it because I'm kind of getting them to look for examples of Remes now as we go through the Gospels.
Well, Scott, many Bible critics say we can't trust the Bible or the Gospels because no other writers from that time talk about these things. Now, outside of the Bible, are there any historical records that support what we read about the Bible?
We have to first understand that any historical records of this time period, the first century, are quite rare because they were written on papyrus or early forms of what we would call paper, and that just didn't survive more than a few decades or a few centuries, unless in a very dry desert climate like Egypt. We know there are a lot of early histories because other Roman writers refer to those histories, but they just haven't survived. So what was in them, how much detail they had, is anybody's guess. But as we get to the end of the first century and early years of the second century, there are a lot of references to Jesus Christ from a Jewish writer, Flavius Josephus, and other Roman government officials. For instance, Flavius Josephus, the Jewish historian, lived in the first century. He was born in AD 37 and died about AD 100. But he mentions Jesus Christ twice in his histories. He talks about John the Baptist. He mentions James, the half-brother of Jesus. Talks about a number of other figures who are mentioned there in the Gospels. And he tells us that Jesus was crucified during the time that Pontius Pilate was governor and Tiberius was emperor. He mentions he was a great teacher. He mentions that John the Baptist had a popular following during that time, exactly what we read about in the Gospels in the book of Acts. And then in terms of Roman historians and government officials, several famous ones refer to some of these events. There was the historian Cornelius Tacitus, lived AD 56 to 120 AD. He was a Roman senator. He governed in what is today modern-day Turkey. Probably one of the top greatest historians from ancient Rome. But he mentions details just in passing in his history how the Emperor Nero blamed the Christians for burning the city of Rome. And he talks about an individual called Crestus or Christus, which is apparently a Latinized form of Christ. And talks about how he suffered the extreme penalty, as he terms it, which is crucifixion, during the reign of Tiberius and the reign and when Pontius Pilate was governor. And he talks about a most mischievous superstition that broke out in Judea, where this started, and even spread to Rome. Well, that's kind of the story of the New Testament church. Mm-hmm. And this most mischievous superstition, some historians believe, and I think this is probably the case, that he's talking about the resurrection of the dead, that this man died, was crucified, and rose from the dead. And he calls it a superstition here.
It was something that they couldn't explain.
Did not know how to deal with that. There was another historian, Tranquillus, who overlaps the time of Tacitus. He was the overseer of Rome's libraries and was a court official. And he talks also about this Crestus being the leader of Jews who lived in Rome, and they were banished from Rome in the reign of Claudius. And this is incidentally mentioned in Acts 18:2 about the Jews being banished from Rome. Another historian many people would have heard of is Pliny the Younger. And he also was an official in what is now Turkey. And in the early second century, he wrote to the Roman Emperor Trajan asking how to deal with Christians in his province who refused to worship Caesar's emperor image as though the Roman Caesar were a god. And he wrote that these Christians met regularly, they sang hymns to Christ as if to a god. And that's interesting because this means they considered Christ divine.
In opposition to the emperor.
In opposition to the emperor, whom they don't consider divine, and they're not going to worship his image. So these, you put all the facts together that come from these other historians, none of whom are believers, and some of whom are, in fact, hostile to Christianity. But we just see some basic facts from this. In the first century, there was a group called Christians that got its name from a person called Christus, a Latin form of Christ. That he was executed, this Christus was executed during the reign of Tiberius and Pontius Pilate, exactly as we read in the gospel. And this movement involved this mischievous superstition. And this is an odd term for a Roman writer, because the Romans believed in all kinds of weird things with their gods and goddesses. And,
but this was not one of theirs.
Not one of their beliefs. They didn't have any concept of a resurrection from the dead. So. And also this movement, they document, began in Judea and spread through the Roman Empire, spread to Rome. And finally, as we just covered, that Christians believe this Christ to be a divine being. So from these sources, none of which have anything to do with the Bible, we see the key basic facts about early Christianity that we read in the Gospels and
It's really wonderful to be able to have evidence like that that supports what we have, because even 20, 30 years ago, there didn't seem to be this type of thing. The Bible was pretty much this it. You know, it's kind of self-supportive about its veracity. But when you have outside sources like this that come from archaeology or other writers that are respected for other things, could be some legends and so forth that are respected far more than Christianity itself.
Sure.
But when you have that superstition and Christus and so forth, Christian is only referred to three times in the New Testament. But it was a term that was used mostly by outsiders towards Christians, because disciple was the term that was used inside.
Right.
But it's interesting to see them call that, hey, theirs was following that Christ figure.
Exactly.
And that's how they recorded it.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating. And most people just aren't aware that there are these historical resources out there. And we talk about them in our booklet, Jesus Christ, the Real Story. All of this is documented in there. People can read the actual quotes if they're interested.
Well, we really appreciate, Scott, your coming and teaching about archaeology. Also, we listen to you online. You can go to ucg.org sermons. You know, you can find Scott's messages, and he has quite a few. Just type in his name, Scott Ashley, and they're very well documented, very easy to listen to. My wife and I are real fans of Scott Ashley and really enjoy the clarity with which he speaks. We really appreciate him coming here and talking to us and sharing some of these thoughts.
Thanks, Vic.
Well, we thank you for joining us on Inside United. Thank you for coming to listen. We hope to have you come back again soon.
This has been a production of the United Church of God, an international association.